Then he remembers that he is away from home, and smiles smugly as he tells himself that home is there waiting for him forever. He goes to the window, expands his chest, and stretches his arms to give vent to the magnitude of his joys upon being alive and happy, and at home in a hotel room 100 miles away, because home is as surely there as if he had never left it. For Ichiro, there was no intervening span of death to still his great unrest through the darkness of night. It was 9 o'clock when he woke up, and the bitterness and profanity and hatred and fear did not have to be reawakened. He did not have to ask himself where he was or why, because it did not matter. He was Ichiro, who had said no to the judge, and had thereby turned his back on the army, and the country, and the world, and his own self. He thought only that he had felt no differently after spending his first night in prison. On that morning, when he woke up and saw the bars, it had not mattered at all that the bars were there. This morning, for the first time in 2 years, there were no bars, but the fact left him equally unimpressed. The prison which he had carved out of his own stupidity granted no paroles or pardons. It was a prison of forever. Ah! Out of the filth of his anguished soul, the madness welled forth in a sick and crazy scream, loud enough to be heard in the next room.
What is it, Ichiro? What is it?
His father hovered hesitantly in the doorway, peering into the blind, drawn gloom of the bedroom with startled eyes.
Nothing.
He felt like crying.
You are not ill?
No.
Not sick someplace for sure?
No, goddammit, I'm fine, Pa, fine.
That is all right, then. I thought something was wrong.
Poor miserable old fool, he thought. How in the world could he understand?
I'm okay, Pa, he said kindly. Hungry, that's all. Hungry and glad to be home.
Yeah, you get used to it. I cook right away.
He smiled, relief flowing to his face, and he turned back hastily into the kitchen. When he dressed and went through the kitchen to the bathroom, it was his father who stood beside the stove with frying pan in hand. When he came back out and sat at the table, his mother was there.
Good morning, Ichiro. You slept well?
She sounded cheerful. The eggs were done the way he liked them, sunny side up, with the edges slightly browned. He felt grateful to his father for remembering.
Yeah, I slept pretty good,
he answered as he broke the yolks.
You are pleased to be at home, and I am pleased that you are here.
Sure, I feel like singing.
She sat rigidly, with hands palms down on her lap.
I did not tell you about Kumasaka-san's boy, because it was not important.
Yes, I know.
Then you understand. It is well.
No, I don't understand, but it doesn't matter.
Oh?
Her mouth pressed into a tight little frown.
What is it you do not understand?
A lot of things. A whole lot of things.
I will tell you. The Germans did not kill Kumasaka-san's boy. It was not he who went to war with a gun, and it was not he who was shot by the Germans. Of course not.
You heard last night when the fellow told about it. It was an accident.
Patiently, she waited until he had spoken.
Germans, Americans, accident. Those things are not important. It was not the boy, but the mother who is also the son, and it is she who is to blame, and it is she who is dead because the son did not know.
I just know that Bob is dead.
No, the mother.
It is she who is dead, because she did not conduct herself as a Japanese, and no longer being Japanese, she is dead.
And the father? What about Mr. Kumasaka?
Yes, dead also.
And you, Ma? What about you and Pa?
We are Japanese as always.
And me?
You are my son, who is also Japanese.
That makes everything all right, does it? That makes it all right that Bob is dead, that war was fought, and hundreds of thousands killed and maimed, and that I was 2 years in prison and am still Japanese.
Yes.
What happens when I'm no longer Japanese?
How so?
Like Bob, I mean. What happens if I sign up and get shot up like him?
Then I will be dead too.
Dead like me?
Yes. I will be dead when you go into the army of the Americans. I will be dead when you decide to go into the army of the Americans. I will be dead when you begin to cease to be Japanese and entertain those ideas which will lead you to your decision, which will make you go into the army of the Americans. I will be dead long before the bullet strikes you. But you will not go, for you are my son.
You're crazy.
He said it softly and deliberately, for he wanted her to know that he meant it, with all the hatred in his soul. Underneath the table, her hand stiffened and jerked a few inches above her lap. Her face revealed only the same little tight frown that he had seen many times before. He waited, hoping that she would scream and rant and cry and denounce him, tearing asunder with fury the slender bond that held them together still and set him free.
Ah, Ichiro, I thought for a moment that you meant it.
I do. I do.
She shrugged without actually moving.
That is what they all say. They who claim to be Japanese. I see it in their faces and I feel it on their lips. They say I am crazy, but they do not mean it. They say it because they are frightened and because they envy my strength, which is truly the strength of Japan. They say it with the weakness which destroyed them and their sons in a traitorous cause, and they say it because they see my strength, which was vast enough to be your strength, and they did not have enough for themselves, and so not enough for their sons.
Balls! He leaned across the table, letting the ugliness twist his lips and fill his voice with viciousness.
Balls! Balls!
He shrieked, his face advancing steadily upon hers. A flicker of surprise, then fear. Yes. He saw it in her eyes, in the fraction of an instant before her hands covered them. To the hands which had come forever between them, he continued to shriek. Not your strength, crazy woman, crazy mother of mine. Not your strength, but your madness which I have taken. Look at me! He gripped her wrists and wrenched them away from her face.
I'm as crazy as you are. See in the mirror the madness of the mother which is the madness of the son. See! See!
He was halfway to the bathroom door with her when the father rushed in to intervene.
Ichiro! Ichiro!
He gasped excitedly as he extended a feeble hand. With his fury at a sickening peak, Ichiro released the skinny wrists and arced his arm in a wild swing at his father. The mother collapsed limply to the floor, and the father, propelled by the painful blow, collided against the wall. For long moments, he stood between them as the anger drained out of his body. He watched his mother rise and go out to the store, her face once again calm and guileless.
Pa. I'm sorry, Pa.
He put his arm around his father, wanting to hug him like a baby.
Yeah, Ichiro.
The old man uttered shakily.
I am sorry, too.
lost my head, Pa.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
He got a bottle from the cupboard and drank it greedily. Then he sat down and offered the bottle to Ichiro. The whiskey was ugly tasting, but it helped to relax him. He looked at his father, who seemed about to cry.
Ah, Pa, Pa. Forget it, won't you? I'm sorry, it just happened.
Yeah, sure.
He smiled. Ichiro felt better. I've got to do something, Pa. I'll go nuts sitting around.
Whatever you wish, Ichiro. It will take time, I know.
Where's Freddy?
Freddy?
Yeah, Akimoto-san's boy. Where do they live?
Oh, Freddy. He was, yes, on 19th. Small yellow apartment house on the south side.
I'll go see him. I can talk to him.
Here, Ichiro,
said his father, placing a $20 bill on the table. But that's a lot of money, Pa. I won't need all that.
Take. Go to a movie with Freddy. Eat someplace nice. Have a good time.
Okay, Pa. Thanks. He pocketed the money and went through the store and on out without looking at his mother. The small apartment house on the south side was not far from the bus stop. He saw it the minute he got off the bus. He climbed up the shaky stairs and consulted the mailboxes, which told him that the Akimotos occupied 2B. Although there were only two units on each floor, six in all, he had to light a match in the dark hallway to see the faded 2B on the door to the right of the stairway. He knocked softly and waited. When no one answered, he pounded more heavily. It was the door to 2A that opened. A plump young Japanese woman peered into the hall and asked not unkindly,
"What you want?"
"I'm looking for Fred Akimoto. He lives here, doesn't he?" The woman opened the door wider, inspecting him in the added light. Her housecoat was baggy and dirty and unzipped down to her waist. A baby cried far inside.
"Freddy's sleeping. He always sleeps late. You can pound on the door until he hears you, or..."
She grinned at him.
"You're really welcome to come sit in my place and wait. Freddy's a good friend of mine."
"Thanks just the same, but I'm kind of anxious to see him."
"Tell Freddy I'll have breakfast for him. You come with him, okay?"
"I'll tell him." He waited until she had closed the door before he started to pound on 2B again. Finally, he heard noises deep inside the apartment. Footsteps padded reluctantly toward the door, and the latch snapped.
"Who is it, for Christ's sake? Who is it?"
Freddy's lean, sleepy face peered up at him through the crack. "Hello, Shorty. It's Itchy."
"Itchy boy, they let you out?"
"About time, I say. About time, I say. About time." The door swung wide open and revealed Freddy, small and wiry and tough. He wore a rumpled t-shirt and nothing else. Ichiro took the other's hand, and they shook warmly.
"What time is it?"
asked Freddy, as they went through the living room and past the kitchen into a bedroom in the back. 10 o'clock or thereabouts, I guess."
"No wonder I'm sleepy. How have you been, huh? What you been doing?"
"Just got home yesterday, Shorty. What have you been doing? Been out pretty near a month, haven't you?"
5 weeks tomorrow."
Freddy dressed hurriedly and sat on the bed beside his guest. "How's it been?" He was disturbed by Freddy's nonchalance, his air of insuppressible gaiety.
"What's what been?"
"Things. You know what I mean. I've been worried." Standing up, Freddy whisked through his pockets and found an empty cigarette pack.
"Out. Nuts. Got some?"
Ichiro handed over cigarettes and matches and waited until Freddy had lighted up. "Tell me, Shorty,
I've got to know.
Crap. That's what I've been telling them. I got my life to live, and they got theirs. They try to tell me something, I tell them shit. I'm doing fine.
No trouble?
Trouble? Why for? You and me, we picked the wrong side. So what? Doesn't mean we gotta stop living.
What have you been doing? Freddy looked irritated.
You asked before.
Well?
Living. I've been having a good time. I didn't rot 2 years without wanting to catch up.
What happens after you catch up?
Maybe I won't.
Ichiro walked over to the window and lit a cigarette. The alley was littered with rubbish, and he saw a cat pawing through a trash can. Sitting on the sill, he turned again to Freddy. He wanted to talk to Freddy, who used to be a regular worrier. He wanted to get under the new protective shell of brave abandon and seek out the answers which he knew were never really to be buried. Freddy. The small muscular shoulders sagged a little.
Okay, Ichi. It's eating my guts out, too. Is that what you want to hear? Is that why you come to see me? You miserable son of a bitch. Better you should have got a kraut bullet in your balls.
That bad, is it?
Freddy looked at Ichiro, and in the face of the little man were haggard creases attesting to his lonely struggle.
You know what I done the first week?
Tell me.
Just what I'm doing now.
I sat here on my fanny for a whole week, thinking, and I come to a conclusion.
Yes. I figured my brains are in my fanny.
Same place yours are.
Looking out the window, he saw the cat still searching in the trash can. He chuckled, disappointed because Freddy offered no hope, but at the same time, relieved to be assured that he was not the only one floundering in heavy seas.
The second week, continued Freddy, I went next door to borrow some smokes. I stayed there all day until the old man came home.
2A?
Huh?
She told me to tell you she'll fix breakfast.
Freddy blushed.
Funny, ain't it? I'm the guy what used to be so damn particular about dames. She's nothing but a fat pig. Can't get enough of it.
Bet she gave you the once over.
How long do you expect to get away with it? Same house, same floor? Don't push your luck.
Aw, can it? I know what you're thinking. Me? I don't give a damn. In the meanwhile, I got something to hang on to.
Ichiro pictured little Freddy in bed with the fat woman in 2A. And couldn't resist a smile.
Sure, funny as hell. But I'll lay you 2 bits you'll wish you had an anchor like her before the week's out. She don't care who I am or what I done or where I've been. All she wants is me, the way I am, with no questions.
Sure, I see your point.
No, you don't.
Me? I've been out and around. I seen Kaz one day. Used to shoot Megs together. That's how long I known him. He's going to school in the GI. He was glad as hell to see me. Stuck his hand out just like that, kind of nervous-like. He said something about being in a hurry and took off. That's how it is. Either they're in a big fat rush, or they don't know you no more. Great life, huh?
I saw Ato.
That jerk. What'd he do, spit on you?
Yeah. How did you know?
We got troubles, but that crud's got more and ain't got sense enough to know it. 6 months he was in the army, you know that? 6 lousy months and he wangled himself a medical discharge. I've been hearing about him. He ever tried that on me, I'll stick a knife in him.
Maybe he's got a right to.
Nobody's got a right to spit on you.
Ichiro reached into his pocket and tossed the cigarettes to Freddy, who immediately lit another.
Keep them, he said. I'll get some on the way home.
You ain't going yet, are you? You just come.
I'll see you again, Shorty. I want to look around by myself. You know how it is. Maybe catch a bus and ride all over town. I feel like it.
Sure, sure. Buzz me on the phone. It's in the book. We guys get together every Friday for poker. We can sure use a sixth hand.
What guys?
Guys like you and me, who else?
Oh. He couldn't hide his disappointment, and Freddy noticed it with a frown. Give me a little time, Shorty. I'll straighten out. As he made his way out, Freddy shouted at his back.
You've been stewing about it for 2 years. How much time you need? Wise up, Itchy. Wise up.
3. Ichiro started walking down Jackson Street, plunging down the hill with quick strides, which bore him away from Freddy, who could be of no help to anyone else because he too was alone against the world which he had denounced. He had gone to seek assurance, and not having found it, had not increased his despair. Freddy was waging a shallow struggle with a to hell with the rest of the world attitude, and he wasn't being very successful. One could not fight an enemy who looked upon him as much as to say, "This is America, which is for Americans. You have to spend 2 years in prison to prove that you are Japanese. Go to Japan." These unspoken words were not to be denied. Was it possible that he, striding freely down the street of an American city, the city of his birth and schooling and the cradle of his hopes and dreams, had waved it all aside beyond recall? Was it possible that he and Freddy and the other four of the poker crowd and all the other American-born, American-educated Japanese who had renounced their Americanness in a frightening moment of madness had done so irretrievably? Was there no hope of redemption? Surely there must be. He was still a citizen. He could still vote. He was free to travel and work and study and marry and drink and gamble. People forgot. And in forgetting, forgave. Time would ease the rupture, which now separated him from the young Japanese who were Americans because they had fought for America and believed in it. And time would destroy the old Japanese who, living in America and being denied a place as citizens, nevertheless had become inextricably a part of the country, which by its vastness and goodness and fairness and plenitude drew them into its fold, or else they would not have understood why it was that their sons, who looked as Japanese as they themselves, were not Japanese at all, but Americans of the country America. In time, he thought, in time there will again be a place for me. I will buy a home and love my family, and I will walk down the street holding my son's hand, and people will stop and talk with us about the weather and the ball games, and the elections. I will take my family to visit the family of Freddy, whom I have just left as I did, because time has not yet done its work. And our families together will visit still another family, whose father was 2 years in the Army of America instead of 2 years in prison, and it will not matter about the past, for time will have erased it from our memories, and there will be only joy and sorrow and sickness, which is the way things should be. And, as his heart mercifully stacked the blocks of hope into the pattern of an America which would someday hold an unquestioned place for him, his mind said no, it is not to be. And the castle tumbled and was swallowed up by the darkness of his soul. For time might cloud the memories of others, but the trouble was inside of him, and time would not soften that. He was at 14th Street, where Jackson leveled off for a block before it resumed its gradual descent toward the bay. A bus turned into the stop, and he hurled himself into it. There were plenty of seats, and he was glad for that, because he could not have suffered a crowd. Sitting next to the window, and glimpsing the people and houses and automobiles, he gradually felt more at ease. As the bus sped down Jackson Street, and made a turn at 4th to go through downtown, Ichiro visualized the blocks ahead, picturing in his mind the buildings he remembered and reciting the names of the streets lying ahead. and he was pleased that he remembered so much unerringly. Not until the bus had traversed the business district and pointed itself toward the northeast did he realize that he was on the same bus which he used to take every morning as a university student. There had been such a time, and he vividly brought to mind, with a hunger that he would never lose, the weighty volumes which he had carried against his side so that the cloth of his pants became thin and frayed, and the sandwiches in a brown grocery bag, and the slide rule with the leather case which hung from his belt like the sword of learning, which it was, for he was going to become an engineer, and it had not mattered that Japan would soon be at war with America. To be a student in America was a wonderful thing. To be a student in America studying engineering was a beautiful life. That, in itself, was worth defending from anyone and anything which dared to threaten it with change or extinction. Where was the slide rule, he asked himself. Where was the shaft of exacting and thrilling discovery when I needed it most? If only I had pictured it and felt it in my hands, I might well have made the right decision, for the seeing and feeling of it would have pushed out the bitterness with the greenness of the grass on the campus and the hardness of the chairs in the airy classrooms with the blackboard stretched wall to wall behind the professor, and the books, and the sandwiches, and the bus rides coming and going. I would have gone into the army for that, and I would have shot and killed some more, because I was happy when I was a student, with the finely calculated white sword at my side. But I did not remember, or I could not remember, because, when one is born in America, and learning to love it more and more every day without thinking it, it is not an easy thing to discover suddenly that being American is a terribly incomplete thing if one's face is not white, and one's parents are Japanese, of the country Japan which attacked America. It is like being pulled asunder by a whirling tornado, and one does not think of a slide rule, though that may be the thing which will save one. No, one does not remember, and so I am not really to blame. But, and still the answer is there, unchanged and unchallenged, I did not remember, and Freddie did not remember. But Bob did, and his friend, who talks of Bob's dying because the father wishes it, did. And so did a lot of others, who had no more or no less reason than I. The bus stopped at the corner with the fountain lunch, where he had had many a hamburger or Coke or black coffee in cups that were solid and heavy, but did not hold much coffee. From there he walked naturally toward the campus, and up on the wide curving streets, which soon branched off into countless narrow walks and drives among countless buildings of Gothic structure, which had flying buttresses and pointed arches and piers, but failed as authentic Gothic, because everyone called it bastard Gothic, with laughing familiarity, as though the buildings were imperfect children of their own. As if he had come to the university expressly for the purpose, Ichiro went directly to the offices of the engineering school. He found the name Baxter Brown on the wall directory, and proceeded up the stairs to the assistant professor's office in a remote corner of the building, which was reached finally by climbing a steep flight of stairs no more than 20 inches wide. By their very narrowness, the stairs seemed to avoid discovery by the mass of students, and thereby afforded the occupant of the office the seclusion to which the learned are entitled. Mr. Brown, grayer and heavier, sat behind a desk impressively covered with books and journals and papers. He gaped at Ichiro in that vague, suddenly alert way that one instinctively manages when startled unexpectedly from a dozing mood. Professor Brown? He knew it was Professor Brown, and he hadn't meant to make it a question. The professor wrenched himself out of his chair and came forth energetically with extended arm.
Yes, yes, have a chair.
He sat and waited until the professor got behind the desk. I guess you don't remember me. It's been some time since I was one of your students.
Of course I remember. I knew the moment you stepped inside. Let me think now. No, Don't tell me.
The professor studied him thoughtfully.
You're Suzu... No? Tsuji...
It's Yamada. Ichiro Yamada.
That's it. Another minute and I would have had it. How are you, Mr. Yamada?
Fine, sir.
Good. A lot of you fellows coming back. Everything all right?
Yes.
Excellent. Tough about the evacuation. I really hated to see it happen. I suppose you're disturbed about it.
No, sir. Not too much, that is.
Of course you are. Who wouldn't be? Families uprooted, businesses smashed, educations interrupted. You've got a right to be sore.
Water under the bridge now. Professor Brown smiled and leaned back in his chair, relaxing.
Admire you for saying that. You fellows are as American as I am, and you proved it. That outfit in Italy, greatest there ever was. You were there too, I suppose.
No, I...
Over in the Pacific, then? Interrogating prisoners, I bet?
Well, no. You see...
Sure. We can't all get in. I was in the first one myself. Did some consulting work for the Navy this last one, but as a civilian. Still, every bit helps. Good to see you're thinking about coming back to the university.
Relieved to get off the touchy matter of war, and who was in it and who wasn't, and if not, why, and so on, until it was too late to turn and run, Ichiro spoke quickly. Yes, sir. I'm thinking seriously about it. It'll probably take me a little time to adjust myself.
Everybody worries about that. No point to it. It'll come back in no time at all. You just pick up where you left off, and you won't have any trouble. I've talked plenty of fellows out of repeating courses because they think they've forgotten so much, and, you know, they all come back and thank me for it. You fellows are older, and you've matured, and you know what you want. Makes a whale of a difference, I tell you. You haven't forgotten a thing. Not a thing. It'll be there when you need it. Take my word for it.
If you say so, but...
I say so. What were you in? Double E? Mechanical? Civil?
Civil.
Makes no difference, really. Big opportunities in any branch. Too bad you're late for this quarter.
Yes.
Well...
Professor Brown stood up and extended his hand.
Nice seeing you again. Drop in any time.
Ichiro took the hand, and while being ushered to the door, muttered something about the professor's being good enough to spend time with him. Outside the office, and alone again, he went down the narrow stairs and hurried outside. That wasn't the way I wanted it to happen, he thought. What happened? He was nice enough. Shook hands, talked, smiled. Still, it was all wrong. It was like meeting someone you knew in a revolving door, you going one way and the friend going the other. You smiled, maybe shouted hi, and then you were outside, and he was swallowed up by the building. It was seeing without meeting, talking without hearing, smiling without feeling. We didn't talk about the weather at all. Only that's what it felt like all the way through. Was it him or was it me? Him or me? He or I? Brown or Itchy? It wasn't Brown, of course. Brown was heavier, his hair grayer. But he was still Brown of the engineering school, of the university, of the world of students and slide rules. And he was Brown then and now, of that tiny office with the books and papers, which was cut off from the rest of the world by the narrow stairs, which one would not think to climb unless he was six and curious and thought that the stairs led to the roof and the big blue sky. No. Brown is still Brown. It is I who reduces conversation to the inconsequential, because Brown is of that life which I have forfeited, and forfeiting it, have lost the right to see and hear, and become excited over things which are of that wonderful past.
and then he crossed the street and did not look back at the buildings and students and curved lanes and grass which was a garden in the forsaken land. He felt empty and quietly sad and hungry. He was halfway through his second hamburger, sitting on the stool at the counter, when Kenji placed a hand on his shoulder. Ichiro turned and looked into the smiling face, the pleasant, thoughtful, old face of Kenji, who was also 25.
Ichiro, is it not?
It was said softly, much more softly than he had known the shy, unassuming Kenji to speak. Yes, and you're Ken.
Same one. At least, what's left of me,
said Kenji, shifting the cane from his right to his left hand and shaking with Ichiro. So Kenji had gone too. Or had he? He hoped that it was an automobile accident or something else that had brought on the injury which necessitated the cane and inspired the remark. Join me, Ken. We can talk, he said, displaying his hamburger.
I've already had lunch, but I'll go for another coffee.
The stools were high, and he had to hook his cane to the counter and lift himself up with both arms.
Going to school?
Yes, I guess you could call it that.
The waitress came, and he ordered coffee, black.
What does that mean?
I'm enrolled. I go when I feel like it, and most of the time I don't. How about you?
No. Just looking around.
Feel the same?
How's that?
Things. You've probably been walking around the campus, trying to catch the same smells and sounds and the other things which you've been thinking about all the time the government kept you away from Seattle. Is it still the same? Can you start back to school tomorrow and pick up just where you left off?
No. It's not the same. And I'm not going back.
Why?
Well, because it's not the same. Or rather, I'm not the same.
Kenji sipped his coffee gingerly.
So what are your plans?
Haven't got any.
That makes it nice.
Does it?
Sure.
Why?
I haven't any either.
They left the cafe and walked slowly to Kenji's car, for Kenji could not hurry on his bad leg, which was stiff and awkward and not like his own at all. Ichiro felt he should ask about it, but could not bring himself to do so. The new Oldsmobile was parked by a meter with the flag up to indicate that the time had expired. There was a ticket on the windshield, which Kenji removed with the rubber tip of his cane. The pink ticket floated down and under the car. Is that the way to do it?
My way.
Get away with it?
Sometimes.
They got in and started down the street. Ichiro sniffed the new upholstery and touched a finger to the shiny, spotless dash.
New?
Yes.
These things must cost a fortune these days.
It's a present.
Must be a nice guy, he said, remembering Kenji's father, who had known only poverty and struggle after his wife died, leaving 6 children.
He is. Uncle Sam.
Ichiro turned so that he could see Kenji better, and he saw the stiff leg extended uselessly where the gas pedal should have been, but wasn't, because it and the brake pedal had been rearranged to accommodate the good left leg.
I was in, Ichiro. Mostly in hospitals. I got this for being a good patient.
I see.
It wasn't worth it.
He started to slow down for a red light, and, seeing it turn green, pressed on the accelerator. The car responded beautifully, the power in the engine throwing the vehicle forward with smooth effort. Ichiro looked out at the houses, the big roomy houses of brick and glass, which belonged in magazines and were of that world which was no longer his to dream about. Kenji could still hope. A leg more or less wasn't important when compared with himself. Ichiro,
who was strong and perfect, but only an empty shell. He would have given both legs to change places with Kenji.
Am I a hero?
What?
They gave me a medal, too. Ever hear of the Silver Star?
Kenji was talking to him, and yet, he was talking to himself. Ichiro felt drawn to the soft-spoken veteran who voluntarily spoke of things that the battle-wise and battle-scarred were thought not to discuss because they had been through hell, and hell was not a thing which a man kept alive in himself. If Edo had been a brave man, if Edo had been wounded and given a medal, he would have dramatized his bravery to any and all who could be cornered into listening. But he was not a brave man, and so he would never have gone into battle and displayed the sort of courage of which one might proudly speak. There was no trace of the braggart as Kenji continued.
A medal, a car, a pension, even an education, just for packing a rifle. Is that good?
Yes, it's good. Kenji turned and watched him long enough to make him feel nervous. Better watch the road, he warned.
Sure.
Kenji looked through the windshield and bit his lower lip thoughtfully. Ken?
Yes?
Tell me about it. The small man behind the wheel raised the leg, which was not his own, and let it fall with a thud to the floorboard.
About this?
If you will. If it isn't too painful.
No, it's not painful at all. Talking about it doesn't hurt. Not having it doesn't hurt. But it hurts where it ought to be. Sometimes I think about killing myself.
Why? There was anger in his voice.
What makes you say why that way?
I didn't mean it to sound the way it did.
Of course you did. I don't say that about killing myself to everybody. Sometimes it scares people. Sometimes it makes them think I'm crazy. You got angry right away, and I want to know why.
Tell me about it first.
Sure.
He turned the car into a park and drove slowly along a winding road, with trees and neat green grass on both sides of them.
It's not important how I lost a leg. What's important are the 11 inches.
I don't understand that about the 11 inches.
That's what's left.
I see.
Do you? Do you really, Ichiro? I think so.
A mother and a child strolled across the road ahead of them, and Kenji slowed down more than necessary.
What I mean is, I've got 11 inches to go, and you've got 50 years, maybe 60. Which would you rather have?
I don't quite follow you, but I'll settle for 11 inches.
Oh.
Kenji was surprised. Ichiro regarded the thin, sensitive face carefully and said bluntly, I wasn't in the army, Ken. I was in jail. I'm a no-no boy. There was a silence, but it wasn't uncomfortable. Ichiro could tell instantly that it did not matter to Kenji, who drove the new Oldsmobile aimlessly through the park, because it was as good a place as any.
Still,
he said finally,
you've got your life ahead of you.
Have I?
I should think so.
Would you trade places with me? I said I would with you. Kenji laughed softly.
I'll forget you said that.
No, I meant it.
Let me tell you about the 11 inches first.
I'm listening. Rolling down the window, Kenji let the cool air blow in on them.
Turned out to be a pretty nice day.
Ichiro waited without answering.
The doctors didn't have to work too hard. The machine gun had done a pretty good job. They were pretty proud about having saved my knee. Makes things a lot easier with a sound knee, you know.
Yes, that's not hard to see.
They gave me a leg, and it worked out pretty well. Only, after a while it started to hurt. I went back into the hospital, and it turned out that there's something rotten in my leg that's eating it away. So they cut off a little more and gave me a new leg. As you've probably guessed by now, it wasn't long before I was back in, and they whacked off another chunk. This time they took off more than they had to, so as to make sure they got all the rottenness. That was 5 months ago. A couple of days I noticed the pains coming back.
Bad?
No, but it's starting.
Does that mean...
Yes. I'll go back, and they'll chop again. Then maybe I'll only have 8 inches to trade for your 50 or 60 years.
Oh.
Still want to trade?
Ichiro shuddered, and Kenji rolled up the window. How much time do they give you?
Depends, of course. Maybe the rottenness will go away, and I'll live to a ripe old age.
If not?
They say a fellow ought to trade in a car every 3rd year to get the most out of it. My brother can take care of that.
How long?
2 years at the most.
You'll get well. They've got ways.
Let's talk about something else,
said Kenji, and drove faster until they were out of the park and once again headed toward Jackson Street. They didn't talk because there was nothing to say. For a brief moment, Ichiro felt a strange exhilaration. He'd been envying Kenji with his new Oldsmobile, which was fixed to be driven with a right leg that wasn't there anymore, because the leg that wasn't there had been amputated in a field hospital, which meant that Kenji was a veteran of the Army of America and had every right to laugh and love and hope, because one could do that even if one of his legs was gone. But a leg that was eating itself away until it would consume the man himself in a matter of a few years was something else, for hobbling toward death on a cane and one good leg seemed far more disastrous than having both legs and an emptiness that might conceivably still be filled. He gripped his knees with his hands, squeezing the hard soundness of the bony flesh and muscles, and fought off the sadness which seemed only to have deepened after the moment of relief. Kenji had 2 years, maybe a lifetime if the thing that was chewing away at him suddenly stopped. But he, Ichiro, had stopped living 2 years ago. I'll change with you, Kenji, he thought. Give me the stump which gives you the right to hold your head high. Give me the 11 inches which are beginning to hurt again and bring ever closer the fear of approaching death, and give me with it the fullness of yourself, which is also yours, because you were man enough to wish the thing which destroyed your leg and, perhaps, you with it, but at the same time, made it so that you can put your one good foot in the dirt of America and know that the wet coolness of it is yours beyond a single doubt.
I like you, Ichiro,
said Kenji, breaking the silence. Ichiro smiled, a little embarrassed. I could say the same about you, he said.
We've both got big problems, bigger than most people. That ought to mean something.
Whose is bigger?
Huh?
I was thinking all the time we were silent, and I decided that, were it possible, I might very well trade with you.
For the 11 inches, or for the 7 or 8 that'll be left after the next time?
Even for 2 inches.
Oh.
They were getting close to Ichiro's home, and Kenji took his time, as if reluctant to part with his friend. Soon, however, they were in front of the grocery store. Well? Asked Ichiro, opening the door.
Mine is bigger than yours in a way, and then again, yours is bigger than mine.
Thanks for the lift, he said, and climbed out onto the sidewalk.
I'll pick you up tonight if you got nothing better to do, said Kenji.
That'll be fine. He watched the Oldsmobile pull away, and then pushed open the door, which jingled the bell of the grocery store, with home in the back end. His mother was at the counter ringing up a loaf of bread and a bag of Bull Durham for a white-haired pensioner. She glanced briefly at him, her eyes sharp and troubled. Feeling uneasy, he made his way past her into the kitchen. Taro was playing solitaire at the kitchen table, his hands mechanically flipping and shifting the cards as if he found no enjoyment in the game. The father sat opposite his younger son and watched. Not the cards, but the face of his son, with a kind of helpless sadness. He sat on the end between them and watched for a while. "No school?" he said finally, noticing that it was still only a little after 1 o'clock. "Keep out of it." His brother spit the words out angrily without taking his eyes off the cards. Ichiro looked at his father with the unanswered question on his face and failed still to get an answer because the father did not remove his gaze from Taro.
"You will wait, yeah? Please, Taro. It is not long."
He turned up the ace of spades and piled several cards in rapid succession upon it. His mouth still open, the father forced more words out of it.
"Mama does not understand Taro, so you must understand her. Try to understand. Until June. Then if she still says no, you go. Anyway, finish high school."
"What's going on?" Ichiro looked from Taro to his father and back again and got no reply.
"That is all right, yeah? June, you finish high school. Then if you still feel the same, I will say nothing. Only a few months, okay?"
The old man sighed, the weight of the problem noticeably too much for him.
"Ah," he groaned. "Then ah," once more.
He rose and got the bottle from the cupboard and wet his throat amply. After only a slight pause, he took a second, shorter drink and returned the bottle to the shelf. Seconds later, he was back in the chair looking at Taro in the same lost fashion. Ichiro tried again.
"What's going on?"
"Birthday party," said Taro, looking up with a wry grin.
"You gonna sing for me too?"
"I might."
"Sure. You can get your buddies from the pen and do it right. You can sing me happy birthday in Japanese. I'd go for that."
The blood rushed to his face, and it was with considerable difficulty that he kept himself from swinging at his brother.
"You hate me that much?"
"I don't know you." He shifted the diamond six to a club seven and put up the seven of spades.
"Ichiro,"
said the old man, and he still did not take his eyes away from the other son.
"Yeah?"
"Taro is 18 today. He came home at lunchtime when he should be in school. Mama said, 'Why are you home?' 'It is my birthday,' he said." "'Why are you home?' said Mama. 'Why are you not in school like you should be?' 'I am 18, and I'm going in the army,' he said." We were eating, Mama and me, and Taro stood there beside us and said, 'I am 18 and I'm going in the army.'"
"Are you?" he asked his brother.
"For Christ's sake, you want me to write it down? You want me to send you a letter? I said I'm going in the army. You think the old man's just talking? Besides, it's none of your business."
Extracting a red 10 from the discard pile, he placed it on a black jack, which enabled him to make several advantageous moves.
"You realize Ma won't get over it, don't you?"
"It doesn't matter." The answer did not disturb him. If he were 18 and in Taro's shoes, he would probably do the same thing. And not having done it when it was his to do, there was really nothing for him to say. It was not Taro who was rejecting them, but it was he who had rejected Taro, and in turn, had made him a stranger to his own parents forever.
"Think it over," he said weakly. "Give it time."
Taro threw the cards in his hand on the table and swept them onto the floor with an angry sweep of his arm. "It's been nice," he said, and he might have been on the verge of tears. "I got things to do." He stood and looked down at Ichiro, wanting to speak, but not finding the words in himself to tell his brother that he had to go in the army because of his brother, whose weakness made it impossible for him to do otherwise, and because he did not understand what it was about his mother that haunted him day and night and pulled his insides into meaningless bits and was slowly destroying him. And it was because of these things, and because he was furiously mixed up, that he had to cut himself free and spare himself the anguish of his brother, which he knew must be there, even if he was a stranger to him. And maybe that was still another reason why he was going. In that brief moment, when Taro looked at Ichiro and felt these things which he could not say, Ichiro felt them too and understood. So, when Taro stalked into the bedroom and banged the drawers and packed a small bag, he felt the heaviness lifting from his own shoulders. He did not even turn to look when Taro swept past him on the way out, for he saw in the fearful eyes of the father the departure of the son, who was not a son, but a stranger, and perhaps more rightly, an enemy leaving to join his friends. Then the bell tinkled to signal the opening of the door, and it tinkled again as the door closed and shut them off from the world that Taro had entered. The mother uttered a single muffled cry, which was the forgotten spark in a dark and vicious canyon, and, the spark having escaped, there was only darkness, but a darkness which was now darker still, and the meaning of her life became a little bit meaningless. Ichiro looked at his father, who did not look as would a father who had just lost a son, but as a man afraid. His face paled perceptibly as the mother came into the kitchen.
"Mama,"
said the father, and he might have been a boy the way he said it.
"We don't have enough nickels," she said,
trying to sound the way she would have sounded if Taro had never been born. But it was not the same, and Ichiro felt it.
"Yeah, I get,"
the father almost shouted as he jumped up.
"The bank will still be open."
He threw on his overcoat and hastily departed. Ichiro started to pick the cards off the floor and felt his mother's eyes on him. He took his time purposely, not wanting to look at her, for the strength that was the strength of Japan had failed, and he had caught the realization of it in the cry and in the words which she had spoken. As if suddenly sensing what was in his mind, she quickly turned and left him alone. 4. There are stores on King Street, which is one block to the south of Jackson Street. Over the stores are hotels housed in ugly structures of brick, more black than red, with age and neglect. The stores are cafes and open-faced groceries, and taverns and dry goods shops. And then there are the stores with plate glass windows painted green or covered with sun-faded drapes. Some bear names of exporting firms, others of laundries with a few bundles on dusty shelves. A few come closer to the truth by calling themselves society or club headquarters. The names of these latter are simple and unimaginative. For gambling against the house, whether it be with cards or dice or beans or dominoes, requires only a stout heart and a hunger for the impossible. And there are many of these, for this is Chinatown and, when the town is wide open, one simply walks into Wings Hand Laundry, or TransAsia Exporting Inc., or Canton Recreation Society, with a stout heart and the hunger, and there's not even a guard at the massive inner door with the small square of one-way glass. Inside the second door are the tables and the stacks of silver dollars and the Chinese and Japanese and Filipinos and a few stray whites, and no one is smiling or laughing. For one does not do those things when the 20 has dwindled to a 5, or the 20 is up to 100, and the hunger has been whetted into a mild frenzy by greed. The dealer behind the blackjack table is a sickly, handsome Chinese, a poker-faced dignitary of the house, whose soft, nimble fingers automatically remove bunches of 5 and 10 and 15 from the silver stacks. He is master for the moment over the kingdom of green felt. But he neither jokes with the winners nor sympathizes with the losers,
for when the day is over and the money for the day's labors is in his pocket, he will set aside a dollar for his hotel room and give the rest back to the house, because his is the hunger no longer accompanied by a stout heart, a sickness which drives him relentlessly toward the big kill, which, when attained, drives him to the next bigger one, and so on and on and on, until he is again behind the table, working toward his day's wages, from which he will set aside a dollar for the hotel room and give the rest back to the house. The dealer flipped up Kenji's cards and matched $5 against the $5 that was bet, for the house had 18, and the young Japanese with the cane held 2 face cards. Ichiro watched Kenji ride the 10 and hit 20, then 40, before he pulled it in and sat out several hands. Over at the dice table were half a dozen young Japanese, who could not have been any older than Taro. A few were betting dimes and quarters, feeling their luck with the miserliness of the beginner who does not yet fully understand the game, or the strained impulses within his young body. And there was one who held a fistful of bills and played with an intensity that was fearful to watch.
"Here," said Kenji to Ichiro. "Play."
He shoved a stack of 10 silver dollars over to his friend.
"No,"
he said, wanting to play very much. Kenji did not urge him. He played 5 as usual, and again ran it up to 40.
"For change, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead."
He traded the silver for 4 20s, a 10, and a 5. They walked from game to game, watching the players for a little while.
"I feel like drinking it up," said Kenji,
looking at Ichiro.
"Fine,"
said Ichiro, wanting to say that he did not want to go any place where too many would know him and of him, for he was afraid. They walked down the ugly street with the ugly buildings, among the ugly people, which was part of America and, at the same time, would never be wholly America. The night was cool and dark. Halfway down an alley, among the forlorn stairways and innumerable trash cans, was the entrance to the Club Oriental. It was a bottle club, supposedly for members only, but its membership consisted of an ever-growing clientele. Under the guise of a private licensed club, it opened its doors to almost everyone and rang up hefty profits nightly. Up the corridor, flanked on both sides by walls of glass brick, they approached the polished mahogany door. Kenji poked the buzzer and, momentarily, the electric catch buzzed in return. They stepped from the filthy alley in the cool night into the Club Oriental, with its soft dim lights, its long curving bar, its deep carpets, its intimate tables, and its small dance floor. There were a few people at the bar, a few more at the tables, and one couple on the dance floor, sliding around effortlessly to the Ralph Flanagan tune, which was one of 100 records offered by the massive, colorful jukebox. It wasn't until they had seated themselves at the bar and finished half their first bourbons on ice that their eyes became sufficiently accustomed to the darkness to enable them to distinguish the faces scattered around the club.
"I like it here,"
said Kenji contentedly.
"Yeah, I see what you mean."
Kenji sipped his drink appreciatively, knowing that the night was long and that there would be other days in spite of the hurting of his leg.
"If I didn't have to sleep or eat, I'd stay right here. I'd work up to a nice lazy feeling and keep it there by hoisting my arm every once in a while. That would be nice."
"Yeah, it would."
"For me, yes. But not for you."
"Oh?"
"I've been thinking about the things we said this afternoon."
"Have you?"
"Yes. And so have you."
He looked at Ichiro with his face already flushed from the liquor.
"Sure,"
said Ichiro. "Seems like that's all I've been doing since the day I was born."
"Don't blame yourself."
"Then who's to blame?"
"Doesn't matter. Blame the world, the Japs, the Germans. but not yourself. You're killing yourself.
Maybe I ought to.
Now you're talking like me.
Kenji smiled and beckoned the bartender for refills. There used to be times before the war, said Ichiro.